Well, I'm Bill Hartley, president of Audio Renaissance, and I'm very pleased to present to you our adaptation of The Book by Alan Watts. It's a brilliant synthesis of the teaching of this beloved 20th century philosopher. And at different points throughout the tape, you'll actually get a chance to hear the voice of the late Alan Watts himself, recorded live, on location, during lectures and seminars. And now, The Book, read by Ralph Blum.
Inside information. Just what should a young man or woman know in order to be in the know? Is there, in other words, some inside information, some special taboo, some real lowdown on life and existence that most parents and teachers either don't know or won't tell? In Japan, it was once customary to give young people about to be married a pillow book. This was a small volume of woodblock prints, often colored, showing all the details of sexual intercourse. It wasn't just that, as the Chinese say, one picture is worth 10,000 words. It was also that it spared parents the embarrassment of explaining these intimate matters face to face. But today, in the West, you can get such information at any newsstand. Sex is no longer a serious taboo. Teenagers sometimes know more about it than adults. But if sex is no longer the big taboo, what is? For there is always something taboo, something repressed, unadmitted, or just glimpsed quickly out of the corner of one's eye because a direct look is too unsettling. Taboos lie within taboos like the skins of an onion. What, then, would be the book which fathers might slip to their sons and mothers to their daughters without ever admitting it openly? Surely the book I have in mind wouldn't be the Bible, the good book, that fascinating anthology of ancient wisdom, history, and fable. It's been treated as a sacred cow for so long that it might well be locked up for a century or two so that people could hear it again with clean ears. The book I am thinking about would not be religious in the usual sense, but it would have to discuss many things with which religions have been concerned. The universe and our place in it, the mysterious center of experience, which I call I Myself, the problems of life and love, pain and death, and the whole question of whether existence has meaning in any sense. It might seem, then, that our need is for some genius to invent a new religion, a philosophy of life, and a view of the world that is plausible and generally acceptable for the late 20th century, and through which all people can feel that the world as a whole and their own lives in particular have meaning. But this, as history has shown repeatedly, is not enough. Religions are divisive and quarrelsome. We do not need a new religion or a new Bible. We need a new experience, a new feeling of what it is to be I. The lowdown on life, which is, of course, the secret and profound view, is that our normal sensation of self is a hoax, or at best, a temporary role that we are playing, or have been conned into playing, with our own tacit consent, just as every hypnotized person is basically willing to be hypnotized. The most strongly enforced of all known taboos is the taboo against knowing who or what you really are behind the mask of your apparently separate, independent, and isolated ego. The sensation of I as a lonely and isolated center of being is so powerful and so commonsensical, and so fundamental to our modes of speech and thought, to our laws and social institutions, that we cannot experience selfhood except as something superficial in the scheme of the universe. We are forced, therefore, to speak of it through myth, that is, through special metaphors, analogies, and images, which say what it is like as distinct from what it is. Myth, then, is the form in which I try to answer when children ask me those fundamental metaphysical questions which come so readily to their minds. Where did the world come from? Why did God make the world? Where was I before I was born? Where do people go when they die? Again and again, I have found that they seem to be satisfied with a simple and very ancient story which goes something like this. There was never a time when the world began, because it goes round and round like a circle, and there is no place where a circle begins. Look at my watch, which tells the time. It goes round, and so the world repeats itself again and again. But just as the hour hand of the watch goes up to 12 and down to 6, so too there is day and night, waking and sleeping, living and dying, winter and summer. You can't have any one of these without the other, because you wouldn't be able to know what black is unless you had seen it side by side with white, or white unless side by side with black. In the same way, there are times when the world is and times when it isn't. For if the world went on and on without rest forever and ever, it would get horribly tired of itself. So it comes and it goes. Now you see it, now you don't. Because it doesn't get tired of itself, it always comes back again after it disappears. It's like your breath. It goes in and out. And if you try to hold it in all the time, you feel terrible. It's also like the game of hide-and-seek, because it's always fun to find new ways of hiding and to seek for someone who doesn't always hide in the same place. God also likes to play hide-and-seek, but because there is nothing outside God, he has no one to play with but himself. He gets over this difficulty by pretending that he is not himself. That is his way of hiding from himself. God pretends that he is you and I and all the people in the world, all the animals, all the plants, all the rocks, and all the stars. In this way, he has strange and wonderful adventures, some of which are terrible and frightening. But these are just like bad dreams, for when he wakes up, they will disappear. Now, when God plays hide and pretends that he is you and I, he does it so well that it takes him a long time to remember where and how he hid himself. But that's the whole fun of it, just what he wanted to do. He doesn't want to find himself too quickly, for that would spoil the game. That is why it is so difficult for you and me to find out that we are God in disguise, pretending not to be himself. But when the game has gone on long enough, all of us will wake up, stop pretending, and remember that we are all one single self, the God who is all that there is and who lives forever and ever. Of course, you must remember that God isn't shaped like a person. People have skins, and there is always something outside our skins. If there weren't, we wouldn't know the difference between what is inside and outside our bodies. But God has no skin and no shape, because there isn't any outside to him. The inside and the outside of God are the same. And though I have been talking about God as he and not she, God isn't a man or a woman. I didn't say it, because we usually say it for things that aren't alive. God is the self of the world, but you can't see God for the same reason that without a mirror, you can't see your own eyes, and you certainly can't bite your own teeth or look inside your own head. Yourself is that cleverly hidden, because it is God in hiding. You may ask why God sometimes hides in the form of horrible people, or pretends to be people who suffer from great disease and pain. Remember first that he isn't really doing this to anyone but himself. Remember, too, that in almost all the stories you enjoy, there have to be bad people as well as good people. For the thrill of the tale is to find out how the good people will get the better of the bad. It's the same as when we play cards. At the beginning of the game, we shuffle them all into a mess, which is like the bad things in the world. But the point of the game is to put the mess into good order, and the one who does it best is the winner. Then we shuffle the cards once more and play again, and so it goes with the world. This story, obviously mythical in form, is not given as a scientific description of the way things are. Based on the analogies of games and the drama, and using that worn-out word God for the player, the story claims only to be like the way things are. Any student of religions will know that this story comes from ancient India and is the mythical way of explaining the Vedanta philosophy. Vedanta is the teaching of the Upanishads, a collection of dialogues, stories, and poems, some of which go back at least to 800 BC.
It's saying that the self in each one of you is really at root one. Just in the same way that you have all over your body millions of nerve ends, each one of those nerve ends is, as it were, a little eye. because all the senses are fundamentally one sense. Now imagine then every little nerve end is a little eye. And it gets its impression of the world, but it sends it all back into the central brain. Well, in a somewhat similar way, every person, every animal, every what the Hindus call sentient being, all those forms that we see may be looked upon as the eyes that look out of one central self. But going yet deeper, we find that it's somehow a necessity of thought that there be some sort of a something which is the common ground of all these universes, all these galaxies. And that ground is the self, as Hindus understand it, the Atman. Now that's quite a startling point of view. Because what it's saying is, you see, that you are basically the works.
But the self of the world, as taught in Vedanta, must not be confused with our usual ideas of selfishness or the practice of unselfishness, the effort to identify with others and their needs. Such unselfishness is apt to be a highly refined egotism, comparable to the in-group which plays the game of we're more tolerant than you. If, then, I am not saying that you ought to awaken from the ego illusion and help save the world from disaster, why the book? Why not sit back and let things take their course? Simply that it is a part of things taking their course that I write. As a human being, it is just my nature to enjoy and share philosophy. I do this the same way that some birds are eagles and some are doves, some flowers lilies and some are roses. I realize, too, that the less I preach, the more likely I am to be heard. The game of black and white. When we were taught 1, 2, 3, and ABC, few of us were ever told about the game of black and white. It is quite simple, but belongs to the hushed-up side of things. Consider first that all your five senses are differing forms of one basic sense, something like touch. But the complex patterns and chains of neurons which constitute these senses are composed of neuron units which are capable of changing between just two states, on or off. To the central brain, the individual neuron signals either yes or no. That's all. But as we know from computers which employ binary arithmetic in which the only figures are 0 and 1, these simple elements can be formed into the most complex and marvelous patterns. In this respect, our nervous system and the computers are much like everything else, for the physical world is basically vibration. Whether we think of this vibration in terms of waves or of particles, we never find the crest of a wave without a trough. We never find a particle without an interval or space between itself and others. In other words, there is no such thing as a half wave or a particle all by itself without any space around it. There is no on without off, no up without down. Hearing melody is hearing the intervals between the tones, even though you may not realize it. And even though these particular intervals are not periods of silence, but steps of varying length between points on the musical scale. These steps or intervals are auditory spaces, as opposed to distance spaces between bodies or time spaces between events. Yet the general habit of conscious attention is, in various ways, to ignore intervals. The point is that they are different but inseparable, like the front end and the rear end of a cat. Cut them apart and the cat dies. Take away the crest of the wave and there is no trough. A similar solution applies to the ancient problem of cause and effect. We believe that everything and every event must have a cause, that is, some other thing or event, and that it will in its turn be the cause of other effects. So how does a cause lead to an effect? This is a problem which comes from asking the wrong question. Now, imagine someone who has never seen a cat. He is looking through a narrow slit in a fence when a cat walks by on the other side. He sees first the head, then the less distinctly shaped furry trunk, and then the tail. Extraordinary. The cat turns around and walks back, and again he sees the head, and a little later, the tail. This sequence begins to look like something regular and reliable. Yet again, the cat turns around, and he witnesses the same regular sequence, first the head, and later the tail. Thereupon, he reasons that the event head is the invariable and necessary cause of the event tail, which is the head's effect. This absurd and confusing gobbledygook comes from his failure to see that the head and tail go together. They are all one cat. The cat wasn't born as a head which sometime later caused a tail. It was born all of a piece, a head-tailed cat. Our observer's trouble was that he was watching it through a narrow slit and couldn't see the whole cat at once. Similarly, a scanning process that observes the world bit by bit soon persuades its user that the world is a great collection of bits, and these he calls separate things or events. The problem would never have arisen if we had been aware that it was just our way of looking at the world which had chopped it up into separate bits, things, events, causes, and effects. We do not see that the world is all of a piece, like the head-tailed cat. We also speak of attention as noticing. To notice is to select, to regard some bits of perception or some features of the world as more noteworthy, more significant than others. To these we attend, and the rest we ignore. For which reason conscious attention is at the same time ignorance, that is, ignorance, despite the fact that it gives us a vividly clear picture of whatever we choose to notice. Physically, we see, hear, smell, taste, and touch innumerable features that we never notice. You can drive 30 miles, talking all the time to a friend. What you noticed and remembered was the conversation, but somehow you responded to the road, the other cars, the traffic lights, and heaven knows what else, without really noticing or focusing your mental spotlight upon them. Of course, to perceive all features and vibrations of the world at once would be pandemonium, as when someone slams down all the keys of the piano at the same time. But there are two ignored factors which can very well come into our awareness, and our ignorance of them is the mainstay of the ego illusion, the reasons for our failure to know that we are each the one self in disguise. The first is not realizing that so-called opposites, such as light and darkness, sound and silence, solid and space, on and off, inside and outside, appearing and disappearing, cause and effect, are poles or aspects of the same thing. The second, closely related, is that we are so absorbed in conscious attention, so convinced that this narrowed kind of perception is the real way of seeing the world, that we are fully hypnotized by its disjointed view of the universe. In other words, we do not play the game of black and white, the universal game of up-down, on-off, solid space, and each-all. Instead, we play the game of black versus white, or more usually, white versus black.
Now, obviously, white and black are as different can be. When we say of someone that he's an awful liar and a con man, we say, why, he could prove it to you that black was white. But strangely enough, black is white in a certain sense, and white is black. If you take the copulating word is to mean implies, because black implies white, and white implies black, or positive implies negative, and negative implies positive, because you can't have the one without the other. It's only by contrast, when black and white are put together, that we know black as black and white as white. However, now, when I look at a small white circle, or disc on a black background, or a small black disc on a white background, I once get this in my thought. Which is positive and which is negative? Does black represent the negative because it's dark? Like night. But when I look at the black dot on the white background, I think the black dot is the thing there, so that must be positive. It was put on. And therefore the white represents negative because it suggests nothing. No mark. Isn't this mysterious, you see, that both white and black can play the negative role? But then let's think of white as light. And it's playing the positive role. And when we think of black as the thing, the mark, then it's playing the positive role. See, both can play the negative and both can play the positive. But still, you can't have one without the other. But we are brought up, we are so brainwashed, we are so bamboozled, we are so hypnotized, that we don't know that. That's the whole trick that we've played on ourselves. We don't know that nothing is something. And it's important. So everything that we think of as nothing, space, empty space, death, sleep, dissolution, decay, any sort of weakness, anything that goes against structure, that is, against the thing, that we think is bad, 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 and we're trying to get a world where that side of things is rendered impotent. Nothingness must no longer constitute a threat to somethingness. In other words, we want to play black and white. And if we'll call white the light and the positive, white must win. That's the game we're trying to play. Not realizing that there cannot be winning without losing. If white must win, black must lose. But if black loses, we can congratulate black for having helped white to win. Because unless black loses, white won't win. And so, in every sort of human enterprise, we are trying to have white without black.
There are many ways in which the game of black and white is switched into the game of white must win. And, like the battle for survival, they depend upon ignoring or screening out of consciousness the interdependence of the two sides. In a curious way, this is, of course, part of the game of black and white itself, because forgetting or ignoring their interdependence is hide in the game of hide-and-seek, and hide-and-seek is, in turn, the game of black and white. By way of illustration, we can take an excursion into an aspect of science fiction which is very rapidly becoming science fact. Applied science may be considered as the game of order versus chance, or order versus randomness, especially in the domain of cybernetics, the science of automatic control. By means of scientific prediction and its technical applications, we are trying to gain maximum control over our surroundings and ourselves. The trend of all this is toward the end of individual privacy, to an extent where it may even be impossible to conceal one's thoughts. The end of the line, no one is left with a mind of his own. There is just a vast and complex community mind, endowed perhaps with such fantastic powers of control and prediction that it will already know its own future for years and years to come. But suppose the human race develops an electronic nervous system outside the bodies of individual people, thus giving us all one mind and one global body. This is almost precisely what has happened in the organization of cells which compose our own bodies. We have already done it. The science fiction in which we have just been indulging has, then, two important morals. The first is that if the game of order versus chance is to continue as a game, order must not win. As prediction and control increase, so in proportion the game ceases to be worth the candle. We look for a new game with an uncertain result. In other words, we have to hide again, perhaps in a new way, and then seek in new ways, since the two together make up the dance and wonder of existence. Contrarywise, chance must not win, and probably cannot, because the order-chance polarity appears to be of the same kind as the on-off and up-down. Taking, therefore, a longer and wider view of things, the entire project of conquering nature appears more and more of a mirage, an increase in the pace of living without fundamental change of position. Thus, for thousands of years, human history has been a magnificently futile conflict, a wonderfully staged panorama of triumphs and tragedies based on the resolute taboo against admitting that black goes with white. Nothing, perhaps, ever got nowhere with so much fascinating ado. As when Tweedledum and Tweedledee agreed to have a battle, the essential trick of the game of black and white is a most tacit conspiracy for the partners to conceal their unity and to look as different as possible. If then there is this basic unity between self and other, individual and universe, how have our minds become so narrow that we don't know it? How to be a genuine fake. The cat has already been let out of the bag. The inside information is that yourself as just a little me who came into this world and lives temporarily in a bag of skin is a hoax and a fake. The fact is that because no one thing or feature of this universe is separable from the whole, the only real you or self is the whole. The rest of the book will attempt to make this so clear that you will not only understand the words but feel the fact. The first step is to understand as vividly as possible how the hoax begins. We must first look at the form and behavior of the hoax itself. I have long been interested in trying to find out how people experience their own existence. For what specific sensations do they use the word I? Few people seem to use the word for their whole physical organism. I have a body is more common than I am a body. I usually refers to a center in the body, but different peoples feel it in different places. For some cultures, it is in the region of their solar plexus. The Chinese xin, the heart, mind, or soul, is found in the center of the chest. But most Westerners locate the ego in the head, from which center the rest of us dangles. The ego is somewhere behind the eyes and between the ears. It is as if there sat beneath the dome of the skull a controlling officer who wears earphones wired to the ears and watches a television screen wired to the eyes. Before him stands a great panel of dials and switches connected with all other parts of the body that yield conscious information or respond to the officer's will. Wherever people may feel that the ego is located, and however much or little of the physical body is identified with it, almost all agree that I am not anything outside my skin. The skin is always considered as a wall, barrier, or boundary which definitely separates oneself from the world, despite the fact that it is covered with pores breathing air and with nerve ends relaying information. This whole illusion has its history in ways of thinking, in the images, models, myths, and language systems which we have used for thousands of years to make sense of the world. It is, then, as if the human race had hypnotized or talked itself into the hoax of egocentricity. Millennia ago, some genius discovered that wiggly things, such as fish and rabbits, could be caught in nets. Much later, some other genius thought of catching the world in a net. But now, if you look at this world wiggle through a net, you see that the net has cut the big wiggle into little wiggles, all contained in squares of the same size. Order has been imposed on chaos. We can now say that the wiggle goes so many squares to the left, so many to the right, so many up, or so many down. And at least we have its number. Centuries later, the same image of the net was imposed upon the world for other purposes, as the lines of both celestial and terrestrial latitude and longitude, as graph paper for plotting mathematical wiggles, as pigeonholes for filing, and as the ground plan for cities. The net has thus become one of the presiding images of human thought, but it is always an image. And just as no one can use the equator to tie up a package, the real wiggly world slips like water through our imaginary nets. However much we divide, count, sort, or classify this wiggling into particular things and events, this is only a way of thinking about the world. Our world is never actually divided. Another powerful image is the ceramic model of the universe, a model in which we think of it as so many forms of substances, just as pots are forms of clay, and as God is said to have created Adam from the dust. This has been an especially troublesome image, bewildering philosophers and scientists for centuries with such idiotic questions as, how does form, or energy, influence matter? What is matter? What happens to form, the soul, when it leaves matter, the body? How is it that mere matter has come to be arranged in orderly forms? What is the relationship between mind and body? Problems that remain persistently insoluble should always be suspected as questions asked in the wrong way, like the problem of cause and effect. Make a spurious division of one process into two, forget that you have done it, and then puzzle for centuries as to how the two get together. So with form and matter. Because no one ever discovered a piece of formless matter, or an immaterial form, it should have been obvious that there was something wrong with the ceramic model. The world is no more formed out of matter than trees are made of wood. The world is neither form nor matter, for these are two clumsy terms for the same process, known vaguely as the world, or existence. Yet, the illusion that every form is made of some kind of basic stuff is deeply embedded in our common sense. There is nothing in the words to suggest that the material or physical world is made of any kind of stuff according to the ceramic model, which must henceforth be called the crackpot model. But the crackpot model of the world as formed of clay has troubled more than the philosophers and the scientists. It lies at the root of the two major myths which have dominated Western civilization, and these, one following upon the other, have played an essential part in forming the illusion of the real person. If the world is basically mere stuff, like clay, it is hard to imagine that such inert dough can move and form itself. Energy, form, and intelligence must therefore come into the world from outside. The lump must be leavened. The world is therefore conceived as an artifact. Someone must have made it, and someone must also have been responsible for the original stuff. That, too, must have been made. In Genesis, the primordial stuff, without form and void, is symbolized as water, and, as water does not have waves without wind, nothing can happen until the Spirit of God moves upon its face. The forming and moving of matter is thus attributed to intelligent spirit, to a conscious force or energy informing matter so that its various shapes come and go, live and die. Yet in the world as we now know it, many things are clearly wrong, and one hesitates to attribute these to the astonishing mind capable of making this world in the beginning. We are loath to believe that cruelty, pain, and malice come directly from the root and ground of being, and hope fervently that God, at least, is the perfection of all that we can imagine as wisdom and justice. We need not enter here into the fabulous and insoluble problem of evil, which this model of the universe creates, save to note that it arises from the model itself. The peoples who developed this myth were ruled by patriarchs or kings, and such super kings as the Egyptian, Chaldean, and Persian monarchs suggested the image of God as the monarch of the universe, perfect in wisdom and justice, love and mercy, yet nevertheless stern and exacting. I am not, of course, speaking of God as conceived by the most subtle Jewish, Christian, and Islamic theologians, but of the popular image. For it is the vivid image, rather than the tenuous concept, which has the greater influence on common sense. The image of God as a personal being somehow outside or other than the world had the merit of letting us feel that life is based on intelligence, that the laws of nature are everywhere consistent in that they proceed from one ruler, and that we could let our imaginations go to the limit in conceiving the sublime qualities of this supreme and perfect being. The image also gave everyone a sense of importance and meaning, for this God is directly aware of every tiniest fragment of dust and vibration of energy, since it is just his awareness of it that enables it to be. This awareness is also love, and, for angels and people at least, he has planned an everlasting life of the purest bliss, which is to begin at the end of mortal time. But of course there are strings attached to this reward, and those who purposely and relentlessly deny or disobey the divine will must spend eternity in agonies as intense as the bliss of good and faithful subjects. The problem of this image of God was that it became too much of a good thing. Children working at their desks in school are almost always put off when even a kindly and respected teacher watches over their shoulders. How much more disconcerting to realize that each single deed, thought, and feeling is watched by the teacher of teachers, that nowhere on earth or in heaven is there any hiding place from the eye which sees all and judges all. To many people, it was therefore an immense relief when Western thinkers began to question this image and to assert that this hypothesis of God was of no help in describing or predicting the course of nature. If everything, they said, was the creation and the operation of God, the statement had no more logic than, everything is up. But as so often happens, when one tyrant is dethroned, a worse one takes his place. The crackpot myth was retained without the potter. The world was still understood as an artifact, but on the model of an automatic machine. The laws of nature were still there, but no lawmaker. According to the deists, the Lord had made this machine and set it going, but then went to sleep or off on a vacation. But according to the atheists, naturalists, and agnostics, the world was fully automatic. It had constructed itself, though not on purpose. The stuff of matter was supposed to consist of atoms, like minute billiard balls, so small as to permit no further division or analysis. Allow these atoms to wiggle around in various permutations and combinations for an indefinitely long time, and at some time, in virtually infinite time, they will fall into the arrangement that we now have as the world. The old story of the monkeys and the typewriters. In this fully automatic model of the universe, shape and stuff survived as energy and matter. Human beings, mind and body included, were parts of the system, and thus they were possessed of intelligence and feelings as a consequence of the same interminable gyrations of atoms. But the trouble about the monkeys with typewriters is that when at last they get around to typing the Encyclopedia Britannica, they may at any moment relapse into gibberish. Therefore, if human beings want to maintain their fluky status and order, they must work with full fury to defeat the merely random processes of nature. It must be strongly emphasized in this myth that matter is brute and energy blind, that all nature outside human and some animal skins is a profoundly stupid and insensitive mechanism. Those who continued to believe in someone up there who cares, were ridiculed as woolly-minded, wishful thinkers, poor weaklings unable to face our grim predicament in a heartless universe where survival is the sole privilege of the tough guys. If the all-too-intelligent God was disconcerting, relief in getting rid of him was short-lived. He was replaced by the cosmic idiot, and people began to feel more estranged from the universe than ever. This situation merely reinforced the illusion of the loneliness and separateness of the ego, now a mental mechanism, and people calling themselves naturalists began the biggest war on nature ever waged. In one form or another, the myth of the fully automatic model has become extremely plausible, and in some scientific and academic disciplines, it is as much a sacrosanct dogma as any theological doctrine of the past, despite contrary trends in physics and biology. For there are fashions in myth, and the world-conquering West of the 19th century needed a philosophy of life in which real politics, victory for the tough people who faced the bleak facts, was the guiding principle. Thus, the bleaker the facts you face, the tougher you seem to be. So we vied with each other to make the fully automatic model of the universe as bleak as possible. Nevertheless, it remains a myth, with all the positive and negative features of myth as an image used for making sense of the world. It is doubtful whether Western science and technology would have been possible unless we had tried to understand nature in terms of mechanical models. A made universe, whether of the crackpot or fully automatic design, is made of bits, and the bits are the basic realities of nature. Nature is therefore to be understood by microscopy and analysis to find out what the bits are and how they are put together. But it is not enough to describe, define, and try to understand things or events by analysis alone, by taking them to pieces to find out how they are made. This tells us much, but probably rather less than half the story. Today, scientists are more and more aware that what things are and what they are doing depends on where and when they are doing it. If, then, the definition of a thing or event must include definition of its environment, we realize that any given thing goes with a given environment so intimately and inseparably that it is most difficult to draw a clear boundary between the thing and its surroundings. Eastern philosophy has understood this basic unity for thousands of years.
The assumptions underlying Far Eastern culture, and this is true as far west as India also, is that the whole cosmos, the whole universe, is one being. It is not a collection of many different beings who somehow floated together like a lot of flotsam and jetsam from the ends of space and ended up as a thing called the universe. They look at the world as one eternal activity, and that's the only real self that you have. I never forget once, I was out in the countryside and a piece of thistledown flew out of the blue, came right down near me, and I put out a finger and I caught it by one of its little tendrils. And it behaved just like catching a daddy long legs, you know, when you catch one by one leg, it naturally struggles to get away. Well, this thing behaved just like that, and I thought, well, it was just the wind doing that. It only appears to look as if it was doing it. Then I thought again, wait a minute. It is the wind, yes, but it's also that this has the intelligence to grow itself so as to use the wind. You see that? That is intelligence. That little structure of thistledown is a form of intelligence just as surely as the construction of a house is a manifestation of intelligence.
Western thinkers have chopped the world up into little bits for purposes of intellectual convenience, forgetting how the bits go with one another. In the same way, the self has been chopped up, leaving us in touch with nothing but our conscious egos. Children are tricked into the ego feeling by the attitudes, words, and actions of the society which surrounds them, their parents, relatives, teachers, and above all, their similarly hoodwinked peers. Other people teach us who we are. Their attitudes toward us are the mirrors in which we learn to see ourselves. But the mirrors are distorted.
You remember when you were a little child and the teacher said to you, pay attention! Or you really must try harder to read, to calculate, to remember a list of facts. And what did you do when the teacher told you to try? What could you do? Why, you made your muscles go tight. You frowned when you tried to read. You went tight round your ears when you tried to listen. So in the same way, the way people screw themselves up and pinch their teeth and clench their fists and frown in order to be mentally efficient is completely irrelevant, just like straining at your seat to get the jet plane off the ground. Nerves do not work with muscles. So therefore, the idea and feeling of ourselves which we have is an inaccurate image married to a futile effort. We have been sold on having a completely false sense of who we are. We've identified ourselves with this image and with this absolutely useless piece of muscular tension. But we're not that. What else could we be? See? Well, isn't it obvious? At least it is obvious to me. It seems so obvious that I hesitate to think whether I can explain it. But it seems completely obvious to me that what I am is what is going on. In other words, as far as I can look at night and see the galaxies, that's what's going on. And this is me. So to me, I've been shown, it is to me absolutely obvious, that there is no other I than the entire universe. What other way could it be? That's equally true for every one of you.
Nevertheless, our society instills the firm conviction that beyond this wall of flesh lies an alien world. It has pulled this trick on every child from earliest infancy. In the first place, the child is taught that he is responsible, that he is a free agent, an independent origin of thoughts and actions, a sort of miniature first cause. In the second place, the child is commanded as a free agent to do things which will be acceptable only if done voluntarily. "We demand that you love us because you want to," his parents tell him. "And don't just love us because we say you ought to." Children are in no position to see the contradictions in these demands, and even if some prodigy were to point them out, he would be told summarily not to answer back, and that he lacked respect for his elders and betters. Instead of giving our children clear explanations of the game rules of the community, we befuddle them hopelessly because we, as adults, were once so befuddled, and, remaining so, do not understand the game we are playing. In fact, the self-imposed task of our society and all its members is a contradiction, to force things to happen which are acceptable only when they happen without force. This, in turn, arises from the definition of man as an independent agent, in the universe but not of it, saddled with the job of bending the world to his will. No amount of preaching and moralizing will tame the type of man so defined. The hypnotic hallucination of himself as something separate from the world renders him incapable of seeing that life is a system of geological and biological cooperation. We must learn to include ourselves in the round of cooperations and conflicts which constitutes the balance of nature. There is no other way for us to survive now. A permanently victorious species destroys not only itself, but all other life in its environment. The individual may be understood neither as an isolated person nor as an expendable humanoid working machine. He may be seen instead as one particular focal point at which the whole universe expresses itself, as an incarnation of the self, of the Godhead, or whatever one may choose to call it. This view retains and indeed amplifies the idea that the individual is in some way sacred. And at the same time, it dissolves the paradox of the personal ego, which is to have attained the precious state of being a unique person at the price of perpetual anxiety for one's survival. Let it be clear, furthermore, that the ego fiction is in no way essential to the total human organism in fulfilling and expressing its individuality. For every individual is a unique manifestation of the whole, as every branch is a particular outreaching of the tree. To manifest individuality, every branch must have a sensitive connection with the tree, just as our independently moving and differentiated fingers must have a sensitive connection with the whole body. The point, which can hardly be repeated too often, is that differentiation is not separation. Our society is defining the individual with a double bind, commanding him to be free and separate from the world, which he is not, for otherwise the command would not work. This is palpably absurd, and since the task is never achieved, the individual is taught to live and work for some future in which the impossible will at last happen, if not for him, then at least for his children. We are thus breeding a type of human being incapable of living in the present, that is, of really living. For unless one is able to live fully in the present, the future is a hoax. In times past, recognition of the impermanence of the world usually led to withdrawal. On the one hand, ascetics, monks, and hermits tried to exorcise their desires so as to regard the world with benign resignation, or to draw back and back into the depths of consciousness to become one with the self in its unmanifest state of eternal serenity. On the other hand, there were those who felt that the world was a state of probation, where material goods were to be used in a spirit of stewardship, as loans from the Almighty, and where the main work of life is loving devotion to God and to man. Yet both these responses are based on the initial supposition that the individual is the separate ego, and because this supposition is the work of a double bind, any task undertaken on this basis, including religion, will be self-defeating. Just because it is a hoax from the beginning, the personal ego can make only a phony response to life. For the world is an ever-elusive and ever-disappointing image only from the standpoint of someone standing aside from it, as if it were quite other than himself, and then trying to grasp it. Without birth and death, and without the perpetual transmutation of all forms of life, the world would be static, rhythmless, undancing, mummified. But a third response is possible. Not withdrawal, not stewardship on the hypothesis of a future reward, but the fullest collaboration with the world as a harmonious system of contained conflicts, based on the realization that the only real I is the whole endless process. This realization is already in us in the sense that our bodies know it, right down to our bones and nerves and sense organs. We do not know it only in the sense that the thin ray of conscious attention has been taught to ignore it, and taught so thoroughly that we are very genuine fakes indeed. The world is your body. We have now found out that many things which we felt to be basic realities of nature are social fictions, arising from commonly accepted or traditional ways of thinking about the world. Fictions are useful so long as they are taken as fictions. They are then simply ways of figuring the world which we agree to follow so that we can act in cooperation as we agree about inches and hours, numbers and words, mathematical systems and languages. As we have seen, troubles arise when we confuse the reality of ourselves and our fundamental relationships to the world with fictions we might have been taught. The nub problem is the self-contradictory definition of humankind itself as a separate and independent being in the world, as distinct from a special action of the world. Yet our whole knowledge of the world is, in one sense, self-knowledge, for knowing is a translation of external events into bodily processes, and especially into states of the nervous system and the brain. We know the world in terms of the body and in accordance with its structure. Surgical alterations of the nervous system give different types of perception, just as the microscope and telescope change the vision of the naked eye. Apart from your brain, or some brain, the world is devoid of light, heat, weight, solidarity, motion, space, time, or any other imaginable feature. All these phenomena are interactions of vibrations with a certain arrangement of neurons. Thus, Vibrations of light and heat from the sun do not actually become light or heat until they interact with a living organism, just as no light beams are visible in space unless reflected by particles of atmosphere or dust. In other words, it takes two to make anything happen. A still more cogent example of existence as relationship is the production of a rainbow. For a rainbow appears only when there is a certain triangular relationship between three components: the sun, moisture in the atmosphere, and an observer. If all three are present, and if the angular relationship between them is correct, then, and only then, will there be the phenomenon rainbow. Diaphanous as it may be, a rainbow is no subjective hallucination. It can be verified by any number of observers, though each will see it at a slightly different position. As a boy, I once chased the end of a rainbow on my bicycle and was amazed to find that it always receded. It was like trying to catch the reflection of the moon on water. I did not then understand that no rainbow would appear unless the sun and I and the invisible center of the bow were on the same straight line, so that I changed the apparent position of the bow as I moved. The point is that an observer in the proper position is as necessary for the manifestation of a rainbow as the other two components, the sun and moisture. Of course, one could say that if the sun and a body of moisture were in the right relationship, say, over the ocean, any observer on a ship that sailed into line with them would see a rainbow. But one could also say that if an observer and the sun were correctly aligned, there would be a rainbow if there were moisture in the air.
The external world goes with you in just the same way as the back goes with the front. How would you know what you meant by yourself unless you knew what you meant by other? How would the sun be light if you didn't have eyes? How would vibrations in the air be noisy if you didn't have ears? How would rocks be hard if you didn't have soft skin? How would they be heavy if you didn't have muscles? It's only in relation to eyes that the sun is light. And it's only in relation to a certain musculature that rocks are heavy. So that the way you are constituted, the way your organism is formed, calls into being the phenomena of light and sound and weight and color and smell.
The relationship between an organism and its environment is mutual. Neither one is the cause or determinant of the other, since the arrangement between them is polar. If, then, it makes sense to explain the organism and its behavior in terms of the environment, it will also make sense to explain the environment in terms of the organism. Does this force us to the highly implausible conclusion that before the first living organism came into being equipped with a brain, there was no universe? That the organic and inorganic phenomena came into existence at the same temporal moment? Is it possible that all geological and astronomical history is a mere extrapolation, that is, talking about what would have happened if it had been observed? Perhaps. But I will venture a more cautious idea. The fact that every organism evokes its own environment must be corrected with the polar or opposite fact that the total environment evokes the organism. Furthermore, the total environment or situation is both spatial and temporal, both larger and longer than any organism contained in its field. The organism evokes knowledge of a past before it began and of a future beyond its death. At the other pole, the universe would not have started or manifested itself unless it was at some time going to include organisms, just as current will not begin to flow from the positive end of a wire until the negative terminal is secure. The principle is the same whether it takes the universe billions of years to polarize itself in the organism or whether it takes the current 1 second to traverse a wire 186,000 miles long. The difficulty of understanding the organism-environment polarity is psychological. We have been obsessed with a false humility. On the one hand, putting ourselves down as mere creatures who came into this world by the whim of God or the fluke of blind forces, and on the other, conceiving ourselves as separate personal egos fighting to control the physical world. We have lacked the real humility of recognizing that we are members of the biosphere, the harmony of contained conflicts, in which we cannot exist at all without the cooperation of plants, insects, fish, cattle, and bacteria. In the same measure, we have lacked the proper self-respect of recognizing that I, the individual organism, am a structure of such fabulous ingenuity that it calls the whole universe into being. In the act of putting everything at a distance so as to describe and control it, we have orphaned ourselves both from the surrounding world and from our own bodies, leaving I as a discontented and alienated spook, anxious, guilty, unrelated, and alone. The universe implies the organism, and each single organism implies the universe. The single glance of our spotlight, our narrowed attention, which has been taught to confuse its glimpses with separate things, must somehow be opened to the full vision. So what? To have spoken of a new vision is to be asked in the next breath, what good will it do? When you come to think of it, this is astonishing, but it is invariably true in speaking with people brought up in the environment of Protestantism. Catholics, Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims, and Taoists understand that vision, or contemplation, is good in itself, even the supreme good, in the sense of the beatific vision, where all beings are eternally absorbed in the knowledge and love of God. But this possibility makes Protestants nervous. The reason is, I suppose, that modern Protestantism, particularly in its liberal and progressive forms, is the religion most strongly influenced by the mythology of the world of objects and of man as the separate ego. Humanity, so defined and so experienced, is, of course, incapable of pleasure and contentment, let alone creative power. The separate person is without content in both senses of the word. He lives perpetually on hope, on looking forward to tomorrow, having been brought up this way from childhood. If you want to find a true folk religion in our culture, look at the rites of Santa Claus. Even before the beginning of Advent, which was supposed to be a 3 to 4 week fasting period in preparation for the feast, the trees are decorated for Christmas, the shops glitter with tinsel and festive displays of gifts, and public address systems warble electronic carols so that one is sick to death of Venite Adoremus long before Christmas Day. Trees are already baubled and illumined in most homes, and as the big build-up proceeds, they are surrounded by those shiny packages with shimmering ribbons which look as if they held gifts for princes. By this time, Christmas parties have already been held in schools and offices before closing for the actual holiday, so that by Christmas Eve, the celebrations have just about blown their top. But there are still those packages under the tree and stockings by the fireplace. When at last the day comes, the children are frantic. Hardly able to wait for breakfast, and not having slept most of the night, they tear those gold and silver parcels to shreds as if they contained nothing less than the elixir of life or the philosopher's stone. By noon, the living room looks as if a waste paper truck had crashed into a dime store, leaving a wreck of mangled cartons, Excelsior wrapping paper, and writhing ribbons. Neckties, upended dolls, half-assembled model railroads, spacesuits, plastic atom bombs, and scattered chocolate bars, hundreds of tinker toy pieces, crushed tree ornaments, miniature sports cars, water pistols, bottles of whiskey, and balloons. An hour later, the children are blubbering or screaming and have to be shooed out of doors while the mess is shoved together to make room for Christmas dinner. Thereafter, the 12 days of Christmas are spent with upset stomachs, colds, and influenza, and on New Year's Eve, the adults get stoned to forget the whole thing. Well, it was fun describing it, but the point is that intense expectation fizzled. Expectation is kindled again to keep us all going for that golden, galluptious goody at the end of the line. What could it be? The children knew it well until they got caught in the rat race. One of the best Christmas presents I ever had was a cheap ring with a glass diamond. It was quite incidental, something that came out of a cracker box at a party. But I sat down in front of the fireplace with this enchanted object, and turned it to catch the different colors of light which blazed inside it. I was in touch with the timeless paradise world. Children are in touch with paradise to the extent that they have not fully learned the ego trick, and the same is true of cultures which, by our standards, are more primitive and, by analogy, childlike. If, then, after understanding, at least in theory, that the ego trick is a hoax and that, beneath everything, I and universe are one, you ask, so what? What is the next step, the practical application? I will answer that the absolutely vital thing is to consolidate your understanding, to become capable of enjoyment, of living in the present, and of the discipline which this involves. But the way is not back to some supposedly simpler time. Just as science overcame its purely atomistic and mechanical view of the world through more science, the ego trick must be overcome through intensified self-consciousness. For there is no way of getting rid of the feeling of separateness by a so-called act of will, by trying to forget yourself, or by getting absorbed in some other interest. This is why moralistic preaching is such a failure. It breeds only cunning hypocrites. Saints have always declared themselves as abject sinners, through recognition that their aspiration to be saintly is motivated by the worst of all sins, spiritual pride, the desire to admire oneself as supreme success in the art of love and unselfishness. The ego trick seems to reaffirm itself endlessly in posture after posture. But as I pursue these games, as I become more conscious of being conscious, more aware that I am unable to define myself as being up without you, or something other than myself being down, I see vividly that I depend on your being down for my being up. I would never be able to know that I belong to the in-group of nice or saved people without the assistance of an outside group of nasty or damned people. All winners need losers. All saints need sinners. All sages need fools. That is, so long as the major kick in life is to amount to something or to be someone as a particular separate goblet. But the question is, how to get over the sensation of being locked out from everything other, of being only oneself, an organism flung into unavoidable competition and conflict with almost every object in its experience. There are innumerable recipes for this project, almost all of which have something to recommend them. There are the practices of yoga meditation, dervish dancing, psychotherapy, Zen Buddhism, Ignatian, Silesian, and other methods of prayer, the use of consciousness-changing chemicals such as LSD and mescaline, psychodrama, group dynamics, sensory awareness techniques, Quakerism, Gurdjieff exercises, relaxation therapies, the Alexander method, autogenic training, and self-hypnosis. The difficulty is that the more you strive for some kind of perfection or mastery in morals, in art, or in spirituality, the more you see that you are playing a rarefied and lofty form of the old ego game, and that your attainment of any height is apparent to yourself and to others only by contrast with someone else's depth of failure. This understanding is at first paralyzing. You are in a trap, in the worst of all double binds, seeing that any direction you may take will imply and so evoke its opposite. Decide to be a Christ, and there will be a Judas to betray you and a mob to crucify you. Decide to be a devil, and men will unite against you in the closest brotherly love. Your first reaction may be simply, to hell with it. The only course may seem to be to forget the whole effort and become absorbed in trivialities, or to check out of the game by suicide or psychosis and spend the rest of your days babbling in an asylum. But there is another possibility.
Now, therefore, when you come to the point when you understand that your idea of yourself is a delusion married to a futility, there is nothing you can do about the one thing that has to be done, which is to be different. There's nothing you can do about it. You realize that. Then what happens? What follows? The only thing that can follow is that you, as we say, observe what is going on. You cannot reject life. You cannot accept it. It simply has to happen. And it happens. It keeps going on. There is this vibration and that vibration. This thought, this feeling, this sensation. Chitter, 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 chitter. Commentary going on. It all out of the memory banks. All that happens. And all you can do is watch it. Can't change it. Because there's no separate you standing outside it to change it. What is happening is you. And you say, I don't know about this. Who's in charge around here? Well, nobody is in charge. Nobody ever was in charge. Because the nature of energy is such that it doesn't need anyone to govern it. It doesn't have to have something separate from itself to make it do what it does.
When you know for sure that your separate ego is a fiction, you actually feel yourself as the whole person, process, and pattern of life. Experience and experiencer become one experiencing, known and knower, one knowing. Remember above all that an experience of this kind cannot be forced or made to happen by any act of your fictitious will. Except insofar as repeated efforts to be one up on the universe may eventually reveal their futility. Don't try to get rid of the ego sensation. Take it, so long as it lasts, as a feature or play of the total process, like a cloud or wave, or like feeling warm or cold, or anything else that happens of itself. Getting rid of one's ego is the last resort of invincible egoism. It simply confirms and strengthens the reality of the feeling. But when this feeling of separateness is approached and accepted like any other sensation, it evaporates like the mirage it is. If, then, you ask me how to get beyond the ego feeling, I shall ask you why you want to get there. If you give me an honest answer, which is that your ego will feel better in the higher spiritual status of self-transcendence, you will thus realize that you, as ego, are a fake. You will feel like an onion. Skin after skin, subterfuge after subterfuge, is pulled off to reveal no kernel at the center. Which is the whole point, to find out that the ego is indeed a fake, a wall of defense around a wall of defense, around nothing. You can't even want to get rid of it, nor yet want to. Understand this, and you will see that the ego is exactly what it pretends it isn't. Far from being the free center of personality, it is an automatic mechanism implanted since childhood by social authority, with perhaps a touch of heredity thrown in. This may give you the temporary feeling of being a zombie or a puppet dancing irresponsibly on strings. What has happened is that the frustrated ego has withdrawn into its last stronghold of independence, retaining its identity as a mere watcher or sufferer of all that goes on. Here, it pities itself or consoles itself as a puppet of fate. But if this is seen as yet another subterfuge, we are close to the final showdown. A line of separation is now drawn between everything that happens to me, including my own feeling on the one side, and on the other, I myself as the conscious witness. Isn't it easy to see that this line is imaginary, and that it and the witness behind it are the same old faking process automatically learned in childhood? Yet, in this moment, when one seems about to become a really total zombie, the whole thing blows up. For there is no fate unless there is someone or something to be fated. There is no trap without someone to be caught. There is indeed no compulsion unless there is also freedom of choice. For the sensation of behaving involuntarily is known only by contrast with that of behaving voluntarily. Thus, when the line between myself and what happens to me is dissolved, and there is no stronghold left for an ego, even as a passive witness, I find myself not in a world, but as a world, which is neither compulsive nor capricious. What happens is neither automatic nor arbitrary, it simply happens. And all happenings are mutually interdependent in a way that seems unbelievably harmonious. When this new sensation of self arises, it is at once exhilarating and a little disconcerting, It is like the moment when you first got the knack of swimming or riding a bicycle. There is the feeling that you are not doing it yourself, but that it is somehow happening on its own, and you wonder whether you will lose it, as indeed you may if you try forcibly to hold on to it. In immediate contrast to the old feeling, there is indeed a certain passivity to the sensation, as if you were a leaf blown along by the wind, until you realize that you are both the leaf and the wind. The world outside your skin is just as much you as the world inside. They move together inseparably. And at first you feel a little out of control because the world outside is so much vaster than the world inside. Yet you soon discover that you are able to go ahead with ordinary activities, to work and make decisions as before, though somehow this is less of a drag. Your body is no longer a corpse which the ego has to animate and lug around. There is a feeling of the ground holding you up and of hills lifting you when you climb them. Air breathes itself in and out of your lungs, and instead of looking and listening, light and sound come to you on their own. Eyes see and ears hear as wind blows and water flows. All space becomes your mind. Time carries you along like a river, but never flows out of the present. The more it goes, the more it stays, and you no longer have to fight or kill it. Once you have seen this, you can return to the world of practical affairs with a new spirit. You have seen that the universe is at root a magical illusion and a fabulous game, and that there is no separate you to get something out of it, as if life were a bank to be robbed. The only real you is the one that comes and goes, manifests and withdraws itself eternally in and as every conscious being. For you means the universe looking at itself from billions of points of view, points that come and go, so that the vision is forever new. Anyone who brags about knowing this doesn't understand it, for he is only using the theory as a trick to maintain his illusion of separateness, a gimmick in a game of spiritual one-upmanship. Moreover, such bragging is deeply offensive to those who do not understand and who honestly believe themselves to be lonely, individual spirits in a desperate and agonizing struggle for life. For all such, there must be deep and unpatronizing compassion, even a special kind of reverence and respect, because, after all, in them the self is playing its most far out and daring game, the game of having lost itself completely and of being in danger of some total and irremediable disaster. It comes then to this, that to be viable, livable, or merely practical, life must be lived as a game. And the must here expresses a condition, not a commandment. Life must be lived in the spirit of play rather than work, and the conflicts which it involves must be carried on in the realization that no species or party to a game can survive without its natural antagonists, its beloved enemies, its indispensable opponents. For to love your enemies is to love them as enemies. It is not necessarily a clever device for winning them over to your own side. As it is, we are merely bolting our lives, gulping down undigested experiences as fast as we can stuff them in, like frantic Christmas shoppers. Our awareness of our own existence is so superficial and so narrow that nothing seems to us more boring than simply being. If I ask you what you did, saw, heard, smelled, touched, and tasted yesterday, I'm likely to get nothing more than the thin, sketchy outline of the few things that you noticed, and of those, only what you thought worth remembering. Is it surprising that an existence experienced in this way seems so empty and bare that its hunger for an infinite future is insatiable? But suppose you could answer, "It would take me forever to tell you, and I am much too interested in what's happening now." How is it possible that a being with such sensitive jewels as the eyes, such enchanted musical instruments as the ears, and such a fabulous arabesque of nerves as the brain, can experience itself as anything less than God? And when you consider that this incalculably subtle organism is inseparable from the still more marvelous patterns of its environment, from the minutest electrical designs to the whole company of the galaxies, how is it conceivable that this incarnation of all eternity can be bored with being? it. To go anywhere in philosophy, other than back and forth, round and round, one must have a keen sense of correlative vision. This is a technical term for a thorough understanding of the game of black and white, whereby one sees that all explicit opposites are implicit allies, correlative in the sense that they go with each other and cannot exist apart. It is not at first easy to maintain correlative vision. The Upanishads describe it as the path of the razor's edge, a balancing act on the sharpest and thinnest of blades. For to ordinary vision there is nothing visible between classes and opposites. Life is a series of urgent choices, demanding firm commitment to this or that. Is it conceivable, then, that I am basically an external existence, momentarily and perhaps needlessly terrified by one half of itself, because it has identified all of itself with the other half? If the choices must be either white or black, must I so commit myself to the white side that I cannot be a good sport and actually play the game of black and white with the implicit knowledge that neither can win? Or is all this so much bandying with the formal relations between words and terms without any relation to my physical situation? To answer the last question affirmatively, I should have to believe that the logic of thought is arbitrary, that it is a purely and strictly human invention without any basis in the physical universe. To sever the connections between human logic and the physical universe, I would have to revert to the myth of the ego as an isolated, independent observer for whom the rest of the world is absolutely external and other. Neither neurology, nor biology, nor sociology can subscribe to this. If, on the one hand, self and other, subject and object, organism and environment are the poles of a single process, that is my true existence. As the Upanishads say, that is the self, that is the real, that art thou. But I cannot think or say anything about that, or as I shall now call it, it, unless I resort to the convention of using dualistic language as the lines of perspective are used to show depth on a flat surface. What lies beyond opposites must be discussed, if at all, in terms of opposites, and this means using the language of analogy, metaphor, and myth. But the fact that it eludes every description must not, as happens so often, be mistaken for the description of it as the airiest of abstractions, as a literal transparent continuum or undifferentiated cosmic jello. The most concrete image of God the Father, with his white beard and golden robe, is better than that. Yet Western students of Eastern philosophies and religions consistently accuse Hindus and Buddhists of believing in a featureless and gelatinous God, just because the latter insist that every conception or objective image of it is void. But the term void applies to all such conceptions, not to it. Yet in speaking and thinking of it, there is no alternative to the use of conceptions and images, and no harm in it so long as we realize what we are doing. Idolatry is not the use of images, but confusing them with what they represent. And in this respect, mental images and lofty abstractions can be more insidious than bronze idols. You were probably brought up in a culture where the presiding image of it has for centuries been God the Father, whose pronoun is he, because it seems too impersonal, and she would, of course, be inferior. Is this image still workable as a functional myth to provide some consensus about life and its meaning for all the diverse peoples and cultures of this planet? Frankly, the image of God the Father has become ridiculous. That is, unless you read St. Thomas Aquinas or Martin Buber or Paul Tillich and realize that you can be a devout Jew or Christian without having to believe literally in the cosmic male parent. Even then, it is difficult not to feel the force of the image, because images sway our emotions more deeply than conceptions. Furthermore, the younger members of our society have for some time been in growing rebellion against paternal authority and the paternal state. Along with this devaluation of the father, we are becoming accustomed to a conception of the universe so mysterious and so impressive that even the best father image will no longer do for an explanation of what makes it run. But the problem then is that it is impossible for us to conceive an image higher than the human image. Furthermore, we have accepted a definition of ourselves which confined the self to the source and to the limitations of conscious attention. This definition is miserably insufficient, for in fact, we know how to grow brains and eyes, ears and fingers, hearts and bones, in just the same way that we know how to walk and breathe, talk and think, only we can't put it into words. Words are too slow and too clumsy for describing such things, and conscious attention is too narrow for keeping track of all their details. We can still awaken the sense that all this, too, is the self. A self, however, which is far beyond the image of the ego, or of the human body as limited by the skin. We then behold the self wherever we look, and its image is the universe in its light and in its darkness, in its bodies and in its spaces. This is the new image of humankind, but it is still an image. For there remains, to use dualistic words, behind, under, encompassing, and central to it all, the unthinkable it, polarizing itself in the visible contrasts of waves and troughs, solids and spaces. But the odd thing is that this it, however inconceivable, is no vapid abstraction. It is very simply and truly yourself. In the words of a Chinese Zen master, nothing is left to you at this moment but to have a good laugh. True humor is indeed laughter at oneself, at the divine comedy, the fabulous deception whereby one comes to imagine that a creature in existence is not also of existence, that what humankind is not also what everything is. All the time we know it in our bones, but conscious attention, distracted by details and differences, cannot see the whole for the parts. The major trick in this deception is, of course, death.
We go to sleep at night. And then we wake up, and because the physical brain is still there, we remember everything that happened the day before. But if the physical brain decomposes, then we're what is called dead. And we say, well, that's the end of that. But when the leaves die and fall off the trees, or the fruit drops, next year, more leaves, more fruit. So in the same way, when you and I die, more babies later. If the whole human race dies, you bet your life. There are all kinds of things that feel that they're human, scattered throughout the multiplicity of galaxies. Because this universe is a peopling universe, just as an apple tree apples. But because we are unconscious of the intervals, we are not aware of the self with our conscious attention when conscious attention isn't operating. But still, just as you don't notice what your pineal gland, say, is doing at the moment, so in the same way, you don't notice the connections which tie us all together, not only here and now, but forever and ever and ever and ever.
Now you know, even if it takes you some time to do a double take and get the full impact. It may not be easy to recover from the many generations through which the fathers have knocked down the children like dominoes, saying, "Don't you dare think that thought. You're just a little upstart, just a creature, and you had better learn your place." On the contrary, you're it. But perhaps the fathers were unwittingly trying to tell the children that it plays it cool. You don't come on, that is to say, on stage, like it, because you really are it. And the point of the stage is to show on, not to show off. To come on like it, to play at being God, is to play the self as a role, which is just what it isn't. When it plays at being everything else.